Accession number 30267, Reel 6.
And you were given an estimated time of arrival. Would that have been worked out for you, Joe?
You were told to bomb at a certain time, yes. It wasn't always possible. You might have all sorts of things. You might have lost an engine but still carried on, which meant you were slower and you had to calculate that much further, the different speeds. But the Pathfinder unit, which I belonged, were very considered, very self-contained. And apart from being given a time on the target, you were pretty well, they had confidence in your ability, because you wouldn't be with Pathfinder unless you had that ability that they considered necessary.
This was really the cream group, wasn't it?
yeah, I think so. But you know, a farmer friend of mine said something about when I mentioned, because when I went later on to the glider pilots, I had a picture in the Illustrated London News of myself, which said the cream of Britain's fighting forces. And my farmer friend said, "Yes, Joe, you know what cream is." I fell for it. I said, "It's only the scum off the milk." However, right, op number 6 was a different target, Oldenburg. Again, the same bomb load, but a quiet trip of 30,000 feet. The heavies received a hell of a pacing below. And this was, in fact, a diversionary raid of 32 Lancasters and 8 Mosquitoes. The main, I don't know that particular night what the main force was. The main target was, but this was a diversionary raid to try to get their fighter command over to that particular area to attend to us and leave the main force perhaps a little less hazardous. This was quite often the responsibility of Pathfinder Force to do this.
That made you rather vulnerable to the fighters then.
Mm. It's better to have a fast aircraft at a height that the Luftwaffe were found possibly difficult. Rather than the main force, which was at a lower rate and in greater numbers, and obviously a much bigger target for it.
Yes, how did you cope with the German fighters in your Mosquitoes regarding speed?
Well, with the Mosquito, unless of course you had a bomb load on board, with the Mosquito, if you located the fighters, which we often did which I come later on to daylight raids, where if you're making contrails, or if your observer can look around and see any unfriendly locals, with the Mosquito, if you opened up to full throttle, they couldn't in actual catch you. But there's a story attached to that which I'll go into later on.
Right, you won't forget, will you, Joe? Because I will have that story.
On most of these diversionary raids, we would drop a lot of window. Window was a metallized strip of paper which had the effect of recording a large quantity of aircraft or objects onto their radar reception screens. And it confused them for quite a while. Op number 7. Back to dear old Duisburg. And again, we had the same bomb load. I've got quiet trip, slight flak, and searchlights behind. So that was rather a sweet one. Op number 8 was Hamborn. Again, the same bomb load, moderate flak, cone 2 minutes, but there was very fighter cooperation very close. One of my friends, a Sergeant Pilato, was hit in the knee by flak at 30,000 feet. Now, my next operation, 9, was on Cologne. Cologne was very heavily defended, but a lot of people don't realize, if you saw photographs of Cologne of 1944, there was hardly, surrounding the cathedral, there was hardly a building standing. I've got one such photograph. And the reason, and the cathedral, most people didn't know this, the cathedral received very, very little damage at all. And it was extraordinary that all around it was completely flattened, and the bridges as well, but cathedral was hardly not touched. We were briefed to avoid the cathedral, and this was possible because of a positive identification of a bend in the river just before Cologne itself.
The cathedral was useful, was it?
Oh yes, yes. The cathedral was, if you could see it. The cathedral was with cloud cover and other sort of difficulties. Of course, the river was the navigational problem. We were briefed not to bomb the, or to keep away from the cathedral. After all, why not? There was no damage. I mean, it's not a war target at all.
Yes, that's interesting. It won't be possible for you to go through all the operations, will it, Joe? Because you had 59, didn't
yes.
you?
I'll go through all the bombing operations and then just a few of the other operations.
Yes,
was
okay.
There.
Yes.
There's a little story I'll tell about of Cologne. Is last year I was invited by the German Luftwaffe Association to go to Germany and lay a wreath on behalf of the Royal Air Force. And whilst there, one of the chaps, one of who been a prisoner of war in fact in England, and their hospitality was absolutely amazing. Their efficiency in the organization of the tour and the ceremony that they had was down to the second admirably. And but afterwards we were in the social moments, one of the chappies said to me, yes, Joe, have you been to Cologne before? And I said, yes, twice up there and one down here. which was quite amusing. Now then, my last operation on as a bomber. Op number 10 was Hanover. And we had, this time we were honoured by actually marking the targets. We had 2 500-pound, but we had 2 general target indicators, plus windows. And my comment in my logbook is numerous searchlights, fighter cooperation, track marker flares, very successful diversion, and the heavies turned off to Kassel. Now, these track marker flares were very disturbing, and it seemed your observer would mention them because you were concentrating on the accurate flying, of course, and left all, most of the observations, because to keep accurate flying, to make sure that you were there at the right time, you couldn't afford to have diversions and mess around otherwise. So you concentrated on the flying and left it to your observer to think. And my observer pointed out to me that as we were approaching a certain direction, so that there was a light on the ground, would come a light, and then ahead of that, another light, come a light. And it was as if they were literally tracking you coming in anticipating where you might be going, perhaps. This, we could deceive them, of course, by we never, ever, except on one occasion, ever fly direct to a target. It was always done as a dogleg to try to confuse the issue with the Germans. So that was my final, I wasn't to know it was my final operation with the bombers, but when we all landed, or the next day or two, we were sent for by our commanding officer and asked if we would be prepared to transfer to the 1409 Met flight, Pampa flight, which was an elite part of 8 group Pathfinder group. It was, of course, meteorological reconnaissance mainly, although they did have other particular jobs, and they were called Pampa flights because that's what we did, pampered the individuals by telling them what weather they were going to experience, what icing index that they would expect, and whatever anything else. It was,
and that would have been day flights,
both day and night.
Day and night, right.
Anyway, that was 1409 Met flight. So we were given a couple of weeks leave and told to report to 1409 Met flight at Oakington.
Before we go to
near Cambridge.
Oakington, Joe, if I could ask you a little more about your bombing experience. Did you ever fail a mission or return from a mission?
Only the number three, I think it was.
Where we
returned,
mm-hmm,
from Volcaron. That's the only, otherwise every single mission was carried out according to the briefing.
And
coming back, of course, was sometimes a bit different.
Would that have been fairly typical, or did you have many losses within the...
We had a great deal of losses. It used to annoy us to a degree and amuse us in a way. The British Broadcasting Corporation used to come out with our bombers again were in the heart of the Ruhr or wherever, and two of their aircraft failed to return. But sometimes that two that failed to return meant that was two out of eight of us, which is a difficult... they didn't explain that, of course. They assumed that there was a lot, it was quite only two lost, but two out of eight was then. And with the result that I think within 6 weeks I became the youngest member, from the youngest member to the oldest member of the squadron. It was... you didn't really... At that time, you didn't really take too much notice of it. I think, had you taken too much notice of it, it would have perhaps got to you and undermined your own faith in your ability, if you like, or luck, as the case may be.
You You were going to tell me about Tommy Forsyth?
Well, yes, Tommy Forsyth was an Australian. And on that particular Cologne target of number 9, we had our call sign, our aircraft was booklet. I was booklet 2-1, and the home station was Roseleaf. And if you were in trouble, you called Roseleaf, and they gave you a vector, which is a course to steer back home if you perhaps lost navigation instruments, all sorts of reasons. And I was on the way back from that operation in Cologne when I suddenly heard faintly, hello Roseleaf, vector. Oh, sorry, hello Roseleaf, booklet 2-3, vector. And I said to Norrie, I said, that's Tommy Forsyth. That's Tommy, booklet 2-3, he's in trouble again. So, and a very modulated, beautiful, kind little voice came back from Roseleaf. Hello, booklet 2-3, are you in trouble? He said, am I in F in trouble? And of course, nowadays the F word is a commonplace, although I don't agree with it. But those days, that was putting up a tremendous black. And of course, he got told off when he got back for his language, which of course, being a typical Australian, was quite natural to him. It was extraordinary with Tommy. He had some wonderful stories to tell. I'll tell you a couple of them. And he said, had a Cockney lad, Jimmy James, as his observer, very nice fellow. And on one occasion, he made three returns on one engine, and he, as I said, if you saw his name on the battle order, it was invariably Berlin. I think of his 17 or 18 trips that he did, I think 14 of them were Berlin. I know it was a tremendous number, and it was of course rather dangerous. He had several returns badly damaged, but never ever got any acknowledgement in terms of decorations for it, and never ever got promoted for it. The reason was he told us he got sent twice to what we used to call the Naughty Boys School. Well, the Naughty Boys School originally was in Blackpool, and they thought there were too many amenities and diversions in Blackpool, so they put it down to Bournemouth on his second tour. And he told me about his second tour. The reason for this Naughty Boys School, as we used to call it, was that if you put up a black and you deserve punishment, they couldn't reduce you to the ranks, because it meant you couldn't fly anymore. So they could only hold up your promotion or give you some other punishment, and the punishment was this so-called Naughty Boys School, where you early morning you marched up and down on the sands, etc. And actually, Tommy said it was quite a jolly. But he mentioned one particular one, his two tours on the Naughty Boys School, which was at Bournemouth. And on one occasion, while they were marching early morning on the sand, there was an elderly lady who came up to this corporal who were issuing left, right, and about turn and all the other orders. And this lady came up to this corner with an umbrella and walloped him. Well, saying, you leave these poor boys alone. You leave these poor boys. Of course, the corporal shouted out an order, but they wasn't heard by the rest of them, and they all marched off, sort of thing. But Tommy, I must tell you this, he was really a lovely fellow. When I wrote my book, there were certain things about which I'll go ahead now and tell you about, which I wanted to ascertain that his family, and I found out that his parents were far long gone and he had no other relatives of brothers and sisters, so I was able to tell the story as it was, so to speak. But whilst Tommy was in Bournemouth, he got to know the daughter rather well, the daughter of a publican, and they had such a close relationship that this young lady came up to St. Ives and stayed at St. Ives all the time that we were operating there, and I was with him. And Norrie and I used to go and meet Tommy and his girlfriend in the pub down at St. Ives, and we were great friends. So much so that when I was writing my book, I was at breakfast and Lucy came in and said, "What's the matter?" Because there were tears in my eyes as I was writing about Tommy Forsyth. He was a lovely chap. And one of his stories was, "You know, Joe," he said, "there we were." I looked round and Jimmy said, "Hey, look at those pretty lights out there. Look at those pretty lights out there. Flak," he said, "oh, flak here and flak there." And I was rocketing all over the place, and there was Jimmy laughing about little lights, and I noticed that his oxygen connection had come undone. So I fastened it up, he said, and I put it on full power, and he said he took one look and fainted. he was full of stories. And the other one was, he lost an engine and was badly shot up, and he told Jimmy to bail out, and Jimmy put his parachute on, parachute on, kicked the door open, took one look, and then he said he was up on my shoulders. He said, "Tommy, you're a good pilot," he said, "you can take me back." He said, "Don't make me jump, don't make me jump." And he said, I had to bring him back, but I made him sit in that hole, and he came back with ice frozen backsides.
Did he survive the war? Did he survive?
No, he didn't.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
When I came back on leave from when I was decorated, I went in to see Tommy, who was in the hospital at the time for what I do not know, but nothing particularly important. And he pulled my leg about the ribbon that I was, the DFC that I was wearing, and I said, "Yes." I said, "You should have had a couple of those a long time ago." "Oh, never mind," he said. Anyway, he pulled my leg about it, and that was the last I saw of Tommy. The very next trip he made after that, he failed to return. It was a Berlin operation, and his name and Jimmy James' name is on the Runnymede memorial of those who have no known graves. It was a great loss.
Did you get upset when Powell's
I think, to be honest, there was only two occasions that I really got upset when we lost a chap. One was Tommy Forsyth and Jimmy James, and the other was an occasion that I'll come across later on when events that happened to me caused the death of another person.
Having
lost my engine on Berlin the first time, Norrie and I discussed this, and we agreed that the dangers of getting back on one were tremendous. And therefore, if we were at that far out and lost an engine, we would try to divert into Sweden. And we had, of course, made plans always to wherever we were. He knew that we could, without fiddling about, pretty well know whatever course we had to take to get to Sweden. That there was only one other occasion where I lost an engine outside of Berlin, but it was with, I wasn't with Norrie, and I didn't have the same confidence, and we managed to get back on one engine. But that was mostly because we were, although it was a daylight operation, we were in cloud most of the way.
But most of your bombing trips were night trips, were they?
My tenth operation was the last of the actual bombing.
Yes,
bombing. We did other special operations, but not as a bomber.
I was also going to ask you about the ground crews.
The ground crews were very important, and I often felt sorry for them, and I tried as far as I could to make life pleasant for them by making few complaints about the aircraft as I could. There was one occasion where I had owed the sergeant, and his name is Sticky Glue, as a matter of fact. a great fellow, an elderly chappy, and on my operation where I came back and thought I had lost my intercom and also the navigation G, he drew me aside the following morning, and he said, you know, there was nothing wrong with your D and nothing wrong with your intercom, but when you were moving around in the cockpit, you pulled a plug out by your elbow or something of that nature. And I spent the next hour going through with him to every plug and every connection that there was in that aircraft to make sure that I knew where everything went in future.
Thank you, Joe. End of Reel 6, Joe Pitch.